This is program number 24 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton is your speaker. One of the most interesting questions that surrounds the relationship of science and faith is the question of what is the nature of man? What is the nature of cavemen? How do cavemen relate to man? And do the discoveries of recent years of hominoids in Africa, and for that matter throughout the world, do they somehow create a problem for those who believe the Bible is the Word of God and are concerned about the integrity of the biblical manuscripts? This is an important question because we need to understand how that evidence needs to be handled, not rely upon a witch hunt, not rely upon an attempt to denigrate science or scientific research, but to understand the connections and the reasons for the things that are claimed. Our fundamental assumption in all of these presentations has been to maintain that science and the Bible are friends. They're not at odds with each other. They're not enemies. They're not on a collision course. They agree with each other. They support each other. They exist in a symbiotic relationship, each mutually beneficial to the other. And yet, we constantly see references to cavemen and the suggestions and implication that the idea of Adam and Eve is just an old relic of mythology and has no real basis of being real or true in any sense or form. I want to try and deal with this in a generic way to provide a basis of understanding, because realize it is not the purpose of this discussion to debunk anybody or anything. If you're going to suggest that somehow you're going to go through and disprove all of the claims about cavemen and new discoveries about hominoids, it changes from day to day. So I want to deal with more generalities in trying to point out the relationship of the biblical concept of man and the scientific concept of man as revealed in the fossil record, the things that anthropologists and archaeologists discover that help us understand something of our past. The first point that needs to be made here, and perhaps we need to review this a little bit from way back in program number 6, is what is God? And you may not think that's relevant here, but it is relevant, and I'll show you why in just a minute. We tried to point out in program number 6 that the biblical concept of God is not a human. God is not an old man in the sky. The Bible has never portrayed God in that way. That's an ignorant position, and it's a position that creates massive problems when you get into a discussion like this about the history of man. When the Bible defines God, it always uses statements that are not anthropomorphic in nature, not like man at all. God is love, 1 John 4, verses 8 and verse 16. God is light, 1 John 1 and verse 5. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth, John 4 and verse 24. Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed unto thee, but my Father who art in heaven, Matthew 16, verse 17. God is not a man, Numbers 23 and verse 1. God is eternal, Deuteronomy 33 and verse 2. God is everlasting. God is the Word. God is unseen. Every description of God, every definition of God, from Genesis to Revelation, is totally non-human, totally non-physical. Now, that's important because when we read that man is created in the image of God, Genesis 1:27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. When we read that, we have to understand that the image that it's talking about is not a physical image. And we spent a great deal of time in program number 7 describing the relationship of man to God and how we are in God's image. The concept of intellect as opposed to instinct. The concept of personality as opposed to conditioning. And the whole idea that the way in which we are in God's image is a spiritual way. It is our soul that is in God's image. We don't look like God. Now, it's important to understand that when you look at the scientific definition of man, you have a different set of criteria. And notice I just said a different set of criteria. It's not wrong, it's just different. It has a different purpose. So man is defined as that animal which has a cranial capacity of 900 to 2300 cc's. That's brain size. Man is that animal that has 50% more nerve cells in the visual center than other forms of life. Man is that animal that has a rounded skull with a vertical forehead. Man is that animal with moderate supraorbital ridges. Well, you can get the point. These are physical characteristics. A vertical foramen magnum, an arched dental pattern, a 2-1-2-3 tooth pattern, an opposable thumb. Those are anthropological definitions of man. They fit the discipline. When a scientist is digging in a cave and he comes up with a skeleton and he wants to tell what the skeleton is, he has to have some set of criteria by which he can do that. And these kinds of physical criteria are the type that are used. Is there a supraorbital ridge? Is there a sagittal crest? Where is the foramen magnum? What is the shape of the teeth? Is it C-shaped or V-shaped or box-shaped? All of these things are physical criteria. And that leads to definitions of man, which have to do only with the way in which man looks in a physical form. So we've all seen charts that show a flow of man, the old Time Life chart from back in the 1970s, taking Pliopithecus and showing a series of apes that led up to Homo erectus and then on into modern man. Those who use this sort of thing to try and discredit God do so in a very unfortunate way, in a very misled way. And I'd like to try and point out some of these difficulties. I hope the first difficulty has already been made pretty clear to you. How you define man makes a difference. The Bible says man is that being created in the image of God. That has to do with spiritual characteristics. The anthropologist says man is that individual that has this set of criteria. And we just rattled through some of those criteria. Now, one point that needs to be right away here is that these two definitions could overlap, but they might not overlap. For example, would it be possible for an individual to have all of the anthropological characteristics that I was listing? The supraorbital ridges, the vertical foramen magnum, the 2-1-2-3 tooth pattern, and so forth, and yet still not be in the image of God? Well, certainly. The physical criteria have nothing to do with the spiritual criteria. Would it be possible for an individual to be created in the image of God and have none of the physical criteria? And the answer is obvious. Of course that would be true. So it's important to understand that we have two different disciplines that have different reasons for the things that they're stating. And it's important to understand that man's basic makeup, his functional makeup, has to do with his spiritual entity, not with his physical entity. Now, a second problem, in addition to the definition problems, is the question of how much evidence is available. In the journal that is designed for junior college science teachers, many, many years ago, there was a bone spray for a specimen known as Lucy. This has become significant in our day and time because Lucy has been traveled around the world and has been presented as a link between us and ancient apes. There are things in the specimen that, as they are laid out in the ground, that are quite interesting. For instance, the skull size. If you're going to say this is a link, then skull size becomes an interesting variable. Because a chimpanzee has a skull size in the 500 to 600 cubic centimeter range, and man is up around 1500, 1600, 1700 cc's. This specimen has a brain size that is very small, around 425 cc's. That would be smaller than a chimp. The mandible, the lower jaw, is available in the specimen. It is V-shaped. If you take your hand and between your thumb and your first finger hold it up on your chin, you will see it fits very nicely. Humans have a C-shaped mandible. This one is V-shaped, typical of monkeys. An ape would be box-shaped. The relationship between the humerus and the femur is another interesting relationship that is used. The humerus and the femur in a human have a 2-to-1 ratio. If I compare how big my upper arm bone is to my upper leg bone, my upper arm bone is about half as big as my upper leg bone. That's typical of humans. In a monkey, they're about the same size. If you measure in Lucy the two bones, they're exactly the same size. You may say, well, I don't understand. If all of these evidences are monkey-shaped, then why is Lucy being touted as being a link between man and monkey? There's an interesting theory that was promoted by a gentleman by the name of Johansson, who's a very famous anthropologist, in which he proposed that monkeys became erect, that this was the process of forming the body that eventually became man. They became erect, and that later on, after they became erect, brain size increased and they became more human. That's his theory. That's how his research has been directed to try and verify that historical aspect of man. In this particular specimen, there's a relationship between the sacrum and the hip that make it look like this individual could have been erect. So Johansson feels this is a support for his theory. That's good science. That's interesting. That's important to investigate. But to suggest that this is somehow a proven link to man is a rather large exaggeration of how much evidence we have. And it's kind of important to realize that when you see all the fancy drawings of these specimens, you have to realize that that is mostly artistic speculation. How much evidence do we have for the various forms of ancient apes, monkeys, and so forth? Well, the answer is that it's very fragmentary. In the Time Life chart, when that famous chart was developed, Pliopithecus, the first specimen on the chart, was built on the basis of one skull, one pelvis, and two vertebrae. Sinanthropus, which was one of the major specimens in that linking, was based upon a single tooth. We have had numerous finds of Australopithecines. At the time in which that chart came out, and of course this number would be many times greater than that now, there were 12 skulls, 163 jaws, 1,053 teeth, 12 pelvises, 2 femurs, 20 vertebrae, 54 arm and hand bones, and 48 leg and foot bones. Now that number is much, much greater now. But that is the most complete form that we have, and it has many, many names. The name of this particular grouping, however, is Australopithecus. Australia, South, Pithecus, ape. There's no question that there were creatures that lived in those times that were different than monkeys and apes living today. And so the evidence is very fragmentary, but the evidence gives us some pretty good pictures of skeletal remains. What the evidence does not give us is soft tishue. There's a monkey called the proboscis monkey, which has a huge, huge nose. Would that monkey have been preserved as a fossil? The answer is, of course not. You're never going to see a petrified nose. So the size of a nose, or of lips, or of hair, or any number of other soft tissues is usually something that has to be guessed at. And many times those guesses can be completely and totally erroneous. So it's important to understand that the amount of evidence that is available is very fragmentary. Sometimes religious people think that when there's big controversies among scientists about evidence, that this is because they don't think the theory is correct or they don't like the model. That's usually not the case. It's usually a case of how we are going to interpret the evidence, and does somebody have a vested interest? Johansson is trying to prove a theory. He has a vested interest. It's also important to understand that one of the problems involved in descriptions of this kind is a failure to recognize converging evolution. Let me try and explain a very simple evolutionary process to you. If you see a dorsal fin coming through the water, what is it? And let me give you a personal testimony. I was in Fort Myers Beach when I was a kid, and my brother was with me, and we were gathering conch shells, which at that time were very prevalent in the area. I'm about waist deep out maybe 50 feet from shore, and I hear my brother yelling and pointing, and here's a dorsal fin headed straight at me. Did you ever try and run in water that was waist deep? As far as I was concerned, it was a shark that was about to devour me whole. And when the thing got to me, it hit me and knocked me completely in the air. My brother said he could see daylight under me. It was a porpoise. And I suppose those of you that are familiar with sharks and porpoises would have recognized the difference in the dorsal fin, but I certainly didn't. Are dorsal fins something that can be used to trace evolutionary changes? Why would a porpoise have a dorsal fin and a shark have a very similar dorsal fin? The answer is, there is one perfect shape to swim in the sea. They aren't related. The porpoise is an advanced mammal. The shark is a primitive fish. But there is one basic design needed for that type of environment. And so a porpoise and a shark and a submarine all have the same shape. but certainly they are not related to each other. Humans and monkeys and apes have the same shape. We can argue about what their relationship is to each other, but the fact that they have stereoscopic vision, the eyes on the front of the head, is to help them have depth perception, which all of them need for the ability to find their food and pick their food. Also, they have an opposable thumb, important for them to be able to pick up the common food that they eat. One of the interesting pictures that I have is a picture of a flamingo's head and the picture of a whale. They look very, very much alike. If I show you just, without telling you the size, just show you the baleen, the material that is used to strain food out of the water, you would think they are closely related. This is, again, converging evolution. It is not an indication that flamingos and whales are connected. There is one perfect type of structure for the form of life that we're talking about. Another problem involved in this discussion is the question of race. I think it's important to realize that sometimes anthropologists get mixed up with this one. There are over 100 races of men. And you say, what are you talking about? I mean, there's black and white and yellow. There's 3 races of men. No, there's over 100 races of men. Because the criteria upon which you describe a race or classify a race depends upon what you're willing to accept as the basis of racial distinction. And let's take a look at one we're all familiar with to get an idea of why that might be. Why are black people black and white people white? Well, a black person has underneath the outer layer of skin, under the epidermis, a layer of a material known as melanin. Melanin is the material that gives them their beautiful dark color. But what you may not know is that melanin has 2 other functions that it serves. Number one, black objects release heat better than white objects. In my high school teaching, we used to have a lab we did with the kids where we would fill up 2 cans with boiling water. One was a black can and one was a white can. And then we would graph the rate at which the cans cooled. The white can cooled off much more slowly than the black can because black objects radiate heat better than white objects. So a locomotive is black because it can radiate heat. At least that's one reason it's black. The other thing is that the melanin is an excellent absorber of ultraviolet light. So if you think about that for a minute, the ability to release heat and to avoid harmful rays causing difficulties for the biological organism give a person with black skin an extreme advantage in equatorial latitudes. And let's just sort of mentally here go to Africa for a minute. What color of skin do people naturally have at the equator in Africa? That's pretty obvious, isn't it? Does it make sense? Well, sure, you got a black man and a white man out digging a ditch in the noonday sun. The sun is right straight overhead, beating down with all of its intensity. Who's going to survive? It ain't going to be the white man. He doesn't have the right equipment for that latitude. Now, as you move from equatorial Africa to northern Africa, as you continue on up into Egypt, on up into Palestine, on up into Greece, on up into Portugal, Spain, France, Norway, Denmark, Sweden. What's happening? The skin color's getting lighter. And incidentally, the eye color's getting bluer and the hair color's getting blonder. It is obviously an adaptation to latitude. This may come as a shock, but God did not equip man just to live where you live. God has equipped man to live anywhere upon the earth, and what is useful in one place is not necessarily useful somewhere else. And it's important to understand then how stupid our racial distinctions are. We're all just different shades of brown. Now, why is this of significance? Well, many times we find people, and this happens more in the scientific community, suggesting that a form of life is a different species when in fact it is not. It is just a different race. If you found the skeleton of a pygmy, and if you found the skeleton of a 6'4" Swede, would you guess that they are related? That they are the same species, they are capable of producing fertile offspring? And the answer is no, I don't think you would. Races can look a lot different and still be one species. You see that in the case of dogs. You see that in the case of humans. So it's important to understand that one of the major variations in this process, one of the things that happens in this process is that racial variations can be construed as species differences when in fact they are not. So we have pointed out 4 major problems with the question of the evolution of man. the definition of man, the fact that the amount of evidence is very small and there can be vested interest in how the evidence is interpreted, the principle of converging evolution, and the changes in race, which may be construed as differences in species. What is a caveman? It's a man living in a cave. You want to see a caveman? Go get your buddy to sit in a cave and look at him. It isn't some notion that this is an inferior individual. The evidence is that the first humans upon the earth were extremely advanced. They did incredible things. They did not have written communication, so they had to start at zero each time that they were doing something. But the process of the changes in man's body is not the issue. The Bible simply says God formed man of the dust of the earth. It doesn't tell us how he formed man. Do you believe that God used a natural process to form the body of man and infuse the soul into it? I don't know if that particular viewpoint is necessarily anti-biblical. The Bible simply doesn't say. Do you believe that God zapped man into existence in a more physical, hands-on type of way? Well, that's certainly a possible viewpoint that can also be taken. I suggest to you that the question of man's history is incontrovertible. God created man specially in his image. What distinguishes us from other living forms is our creation with a spiritual nature in God's image. I personally think the evidence is quite good that man was uniquely formed of the dust of the earth. But I remain open to the fact that as new discoveries are made, we're going to find the history of apes, the history of primates, to be something that gives us a great deal of insight as to some other possibilities. Man is special, uniquely created in the image of God. That is what sets us apart. That is what is important. And as people continue to study the evidence of the history of man upon the earth, they will answer some of these questions about the amount of evidence. Eventually, the vested interest will come up with a model, with a piece of proof that is so good that nobody will contest it. Eventually, the difficulties of why we look so much like some of our neighbors, is it converging evolution or is it because we are directly related, will be answered. Racial variations and the effect of race upon man, some of these very, very small men found in Indonesia, may indicate an enormous variation is possible in the gene pool. I come back to the fundamental point that we started this discussion with. Man is that being uniquely created in the image of God. It is not our physical makeup that makes us unique. We have been created in God's image. We have a makeup that is special because God is a spirit and we are in his image. And our ability to create art, our ability to worship God, our ability to create music, our ability to feel guilt, to be sympathetic, these are a function of our spiritual nature in God's image. The physical body in which we are housed is not an issue. And eventually, and everybody has to agree on this, that body will be dust to dust. It is our spiritual makeup that moves on, not our physical makeup. The Bible deals with man's spiritual makeup, how we are in God's image. The physical makeup of man's body is not of concern to the biblical writers and should not be used in any way to attempt to discredit the integrity of God's word.